Thanks again, Mr. Bauer. As was mentioned in the sermonette, we are just five days away from another anniversary of the independence of this nation. I would say at this time, maybe even more than others, the entire country, or I shouldn't say entire, let's say many in the country, are in a stir about who will be the next president of the United States of America. With the debate this past Thursday between the two main candidates, the impassioned rhetoric about who's more qualified for the job has only gotten louder than ever. And frankly, more embarrassing than ever. I don't know how many of you tuned in to listen in on that event, but embarrassing, I think, is a fitting word. That the prospective leaders of the nation bicker about things as if you're listening to a debate on a school ground. Insults and prideful claims of superiority rule the stage, rather than respectful disagreement or civility. It seems like election season never really ends anymore, but we're definitely stepping into the height of it in this period between now and November. We know that that hot debate about who should be in charge for the next 4 years is only going to get more and more intense between now and Election Day. Maybe it's just me noticing more of it as I get older and observe more of the process, but it seems that many Americans are especially desperate this time around to make sure they pick the right person for the job. We've got to find a way to make things better. Of course, right is extremely subjective and often ignores one evil attribute or viewpoint of one candidate to promote another good quality that they might have and consider that one more important. Yeah, we'll put up with this evil quality because of this good perspective they have. It really is choosing the lesser of the two evils in many people's minds and approach. And I think that's true because it's a vivid picture of the effects of eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's a mixture of both good and evil that's produced by human beings when they take on the role of defining right and wrong for themselves. How is a true Christian living in this country during a time like this supposed to respond? How are we supposed to handle this political environment in this world that we're living in? You know, some take the route of actively choosing the lesser of the two evils from their perspective and supporting one candidate or party whom they view as less evil as the other, less evil than the other, and then actively promoting that person, encouraging other people to do the same. Others who recognize the futility of getting involved in the politics of this world might profess that they're not part of this political system, while often subconsciously, without even maybe realizing it, silently supporting one candidate over another, claiming not to be part of the systems of this world, while at the same time rooting for one party over the other. If we're honest with ourselves, many of us have probably gotten caught up in that approach, way of thinking, as if red is more righteous than blue, or blue is more righteous than red, but we forget one thing. There is no righteous party! They're both a mixture of good and evil. When we fail to recognize that, apologize to my wife if I woke up the baby, I'll try to calm down a little bit. When we fail to recognize that both parties are a mixture of good and evil, Satan can gain a foothold in getting us to subtly look to the leaders of this world for solutions to mankind's problems instead of longing for the one and only answer, the kingdom of God. Regardless of which political party holds the majority or which individual fills the seat in the highest office in the land, how are we, as God's people, dwelling in this country, supposed to respond? How should a change in physical leadership affect us? And wouldn't it be nice if we had a righteous example in Scripture to look to of how to deal with the passing of the baton of leadership? Well, I believe we do. The Bible is filled with many vivid, practical examples for our lives if we look for them. And there's one individual in particular that comes to mind when I think about how are God's people supposed to deal with this stuff? This changing of power, this deciding who's in charge now, how is it supposed to affect us? How are we supposed to deal with it? How are we supposed to live in that period of time where this striving for power is going on? What would a righteous response to that passing of the baton look like? Where can we look for that kind of example? Well, I propose the book of Daniel. Daniel served under four different kings in two different world-ruling empires. And he experienced change and upheaval and political anxiety and uncertainty and prosperity and conquest. He experienced the ups and downs of these transitions. Yet Daniel remained a consistent example through it all. Daniel was subject to many kings, but he was always a servant to the king. That's really the point, the basis for this entire message. Daniel was a servant to the king, capital K, regardless of the king, lowercase k. It didn't matter who was sitting on a physical throne. Daniel knew who he was really serving, who his king really was. And that's why his example is so powerful, I think, for us today. What can we learn from that example? What can we glean from his life story that might motivate us to likewise be servants to the king, regardless of who sits on a physical throne? Whether that's king, queen, president, prime minister, etc. Today I want to review several parts of Daniel's story and make some observations that hopefully will be helpful for us as we try to navigate the current political climate we're living in this nation. Daniel's example transcends the reign of several different kings, and I think we can learn a lot from it. Let's go to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1, we'll begin in verse 1. Daniel 1, verse 1, which tells us, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. I mean, that's pretty simply stated, but there's so much that goes into that one verse. So much written in the prophets describing that time. What went on during this period of time when Jerusalem was besieged? Well, some pretty horrific things. Famine, disease, people so desperate for some kind of fuel for their bodies that it's even described of people feeding on their offspring. I was trying to use big words so that some in the room might not pick up on exactly what I'm saying there, but they're not that big of words. It's in the Word of God, it's reality. Not to be gruesome, but Daniel experienced a lot. First point, first lesson I think we can glean from his example is that hardship did not alter his view of God's sovereignty. Hardship did not alter Daniel's view of God's sovereignty. Yes, Jerusalem was besieged. The king of Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, surrounded the city. This waiting game of basically trying to starve the people out of the city before the wall was finally breached and it was conquered. Verse 2, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of King Nebuchadnezzar, with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. So he sacked the city, he brought back, you know, the bounty from the city of Jerusalem, including articles from the very temple of God. Verse 3, then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Consider who these young men were and what they had just experienced. They were not just bright, ambitious young men showing up for a job interview. They were captives from Judah. Captives from this city that was overcome by Nebuchadnezzar, where they had witnessed the destruction of their home country, where they had witnessed or experienced famine, war, the besieging of the city, death, perhaps the loss of people that they loved and cared about. They had been brought to a foreign land to dwell in servitude. And now these young men had been taken from their own families, if they had any family left with them in Babylon, and they're taken to the palace to serve the king. These were bright young men in whom was no blemish, good-looking, gifted, intelligent. Many commentators estimate that Daniel and his friends were probably in their teens, maybe older teenagers. They were young men with a promising future, until Judah was given over into the hand of this king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, until this hardship completely turned their lives upside down. This transition of power that had been prophesied ahead of time completely altered Daniel's life course. But we can note here in 2 Kings chapter 20, if you'll go there with me, that this transition of power had been prophesied and spoken about back in Hezekiah's time. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 20. And notice something specific that Hezekiah was told here about his own descendants. 2 Kings 20, verse 12. This is right on the heels of the time in Hezekiah's life when he was sick and he was told he was going to die. Yet he cried out in faith and in prayer to God, asking God to have mercy on him, and God healed him, added 15 years to his life. What's interesting, in another account, it says what's about to take place, that during this period, God departed from Hezekiah to test him. He didn't control Hezekiah's choices. He didn't always send up, you know, the red flags of warning. He wanted to see where Hezekiah's focus was, where his heart was. So, in verse 12, at that time, Berodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And Hezekiah was attentive to them and showed them all the house of his treasures, the silver and gold, the spices and precious ointments, and all his armory, all that was found among his treasures. There was nothing in his house or in all his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and said to him, "What did these men say, and from where did they come to you?" So Hezekiah said, "They came from a far country, from Babylon." And he said, "What have they seen in your house?" So Hezekiah answered, "They've seen all that is in my house. There's nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them." Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and what your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord." And verse 18, notice this. "And they shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." Then Hezekiah says in verse 19 to Isaiah, "The word of the Lord which you have spoken is good." For he said, "Will there not be peace and truth, at least in my day?" I mean, what a perspective here. Okay, my descendants are going to have to suffer, but at least, whew, I know I'm not going to have to live through that time period. Verse 18, though, really verses 17 and 18, are this prophecy that the city of Jerusalem would be overthrown by the king of Babylon, and specifically that descendants of King Hezekiah would become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. If you go back to Daniel chapter 1, in verse 3, We read the verse already, but now with that prophecy in mind, verse 3 said, the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children and of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men, etc., etc., to be trained for this three-year period to serve in the palace of the king. Do you notice who was in charge of these young men that were experiencing this special training? It was the master of the eunuchs. See, it had been prophesied back in 2 Kings 20 that the city would be overthrown, they'd be taken, and that even some of Hezekiah's descendants would be taken into captivity, into service in the palace of the king, to become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. And now we see that being fulfilled in Daniel chapter 1. Now, was Daniel himself a direct descendant of King Hezekiah? We're not told. But he was among this group that included some of the king's descendants and some nobles. The master of the eunuchs had responsibility over these young men and their training. Now, exactly what that means, that these young men would join the ranks of the eunuchs, is debated by scholars. The word used for eunuchs here in Daniel chapter 1 comes from a root word meaning to castrate. And it was a practice of different ancient rulers at different times in human history to castrate some of their servants or advisors before putting them into the service in their palace, in their administration. Some say this was done to subdue and pacify these men. Some sources say this was done so that the ruler could maybe have a little more trust in these men to be advisors, because he wouldn't have to worry about them trying to overthrow him and create their own dynasty. If they can't have offspring of their own, they can't create their own new dynasty and overthrow the king. Others say this was done so that there could be more trust in having the eunuchs care for the women in the king's harem, for example. But in all fairness, the same term that's translated eunuch here can also be descriptive of an office, an official or an officer. It doesn't have to be strictly focused on what we think of as the physical component of being a eunuch. For example, the same Hebrew word is used in the accounts between Joseph and Potiphar. It says in Genesis 37, verse 36, it describes Potiphar as an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And that word officer is the same Hebrew word that's translated eunuch. Now, let's think logically about that. Potiphar had a wife who he accused Joseph of, obviously, doing impure things with. But the fact that Potiphar had a wife and the same term for eunuch is possible evidence that it did not always involve the physical act of being made a eunuch, but simply referring to an office, a position of service in some type of government position. It can simply mean a minister of the state, a chamberlain, a eunuch, or an officer. So which is the case regarding Daniel and his three friends? We don't know. We don't know for sure. But regardless of whether or not they were made eunuchs physically, their whole lives were upturned. And we do have no reference to Daniel being married or bearing children. Maybe he did. But I would guess, as a captive from a foreign land, being forced to serve in a king's palace, you wouldn't have some of the freedoms that maybe you dreamed of as a young teenager. The goals that he had for his life, the freedoms to pursue success, marriage, family, etc., were completely changed because of this transition of power, because of this evil king and what he had done to the people of Judah. So whether that involved physical castration or not, that doesn't really change the matter that Daniel and his three friends went through a lot of hardship, had their lives completely turned about. And I think we need to appreciate some of the things that Daniel went through, where he came from, who he was, if we're going to appreciate the lessons that we can glean from him. He was no doubt a faithful prophet of God, whom God used to record some incredible things about the future. But first, he was a young person who had his whole world upside down by the hardships of his control. His life changed, his heart destroyed, people treated harshly. How easy would it have been for him to live in hostility? In hostility toward Nebuchadnezzar? Also in hostility toward God. I mean, how could God let him? God, the Almighty Eternal, whom he'd been taught about, whom he had purposed to obey, allowed him to experience some of these hardships. And yet, Daniel, the incredible example that he is, could still say what's recorded for us here in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 20. And what was his perspective about God? What was his perspective about who was really in control of his life? Who was really his king? Even regardless of the hardships he experienced? Daniel 2, verse 20 says, Daniel answered and said, speaking to Nebuchadnezzar here, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him." You see, this bright, good-looking young man, possibly with noble lineage, now turned foreign captive, serving under a harsh and brutal king, he was still able to stop and say, "You know what? God is in control." This transition of power did not escape God's purview. God wasn't unaware of it. He said, God removes kings and sets up kings. He's allowed this. He's directed it. That statement that God removes kings and raises up kings is not only a fact, it's an incredible example of faith and trust, considering Daniel's background. He could say these words with confidence to the physical king ruling over him because Daniel was a servant to the true king. He believed and trusted that God was sovereign. He was in complete power and control, the ultimate authority in his life, regardless of the hardships he experienced. And what about us, brethren? Regardless of any hardships we might experience, maybe even at the hand of a leader with evil intentions, moral failings, wrong perspectives in comparison to the Word of God, do we trust that God is above all, that he's in control, that he removes kings and raises up kings? Let's go back to Daniel. Well, just back a few verses, I guess, to verse 44. Verse 44, we're going to be kind of jumping in and out of some prophecies in the book today, because it's not the meanings of the prophecies themselves that I want to highlight, but the attitude of the prophet Daniel himself that I want to point out here. I believe Daniel knew where the transfers of power that he would live through would ultimately lead. He knew it because in chapter 2, he was explaining this meaning of this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had had, of this image made of these different materials. And as he explained the interpretation of it, representing different world-ruling empires down through time. But Daniel understood where it all ultimately led and who was ultimately in charge and would be in charge forever. Verse 44, Daniel 2, verse 44. "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom that shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." David believed and understood that, and it no doubt shaped his perspective on the temporary kingdoms of this world, the temporary leaders that had the opportunity to be in these positions of power. Yet he knew God was sovereign nonetheless. The hardships he experienced as a result of the kingdoms of men would not shake his faith in the coming kingdom of God. Is that true for you and me? Do we believe that God rules? Do we believe he's sovereign, possessing supreme authority and power, even in the midst of a controversial election season? Even if a candidate is elected that nibbles on the fruit of the wrong tree, maybe more so than another candidate that also nibbles on fruit from the wrong tree? Do we believe that God is ultimately in control? Could we echo the words here of Daniel in Daniel chapter 4, verse 17? Daniel 4, verse 17. Again, describing and interpreting a different dream at this time. I just want to note what he says in the second half of verse 17, what he says about God. He says, In order that the living may know that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. And do we believe that? Do we believe that even if someone is elected to a position of leadership who is not striving to obey the laws of God, and I think we would agree, neither candidate are, do we still believe that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men? That he's in ultimate authority and control? Regardless of the hardships we may experience or the perceived hardships we only fear about a certain leader being elected over another, we have to be like Daniel and remember that ultimately it's the Most High that rules. That's part of being servants to the heavenly king, regardless of who occupies an earthly throne. So, the hardships Daniel experienced did not change his perspective on the fact that God ultimately was sovereign and in control. Let's move on to a second point. Point number two. Circumstances did not change Daniel's convictions. Circumstances did not change his convictions. Let's go back to chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. We read the first 6 verses. We'll pick it up in verse 7. Daniel 1 through 6, we read that, described these four young men who would be serving among the others in the group. Then verse 7, Daniel 1 verse 7. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Why the new names? They're brought in to have this training, learn about the culture and the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Why give them these new names? Well, let's consider the meanings of some of these names. Daniel means God is my judge. The name he was given, Belteshazzar, means Bel's prince, or he whom Bel favors. A reference to a false god, Bel. So his name changed from something promoting the character of God, instead focusing on some false god of the Babylonians. Hananiah. No, I'm not calling one of my daughters, although I do refer to her as Hananiah sometimes. Hananiah, this young man, his name meant God has favored, or whom Jehovah has graciously given. But his name was changed to Shadrach. Several different possibilities for the meaning of that name, but Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, I found this one helpful. It mentions young friend of the king or the son. The same root word is involved here as in Abrek, Shadrach, Abrek, meaning inspired or illuminated by the sun god. So again, the change from a name showing honor and praise and worship to God and the fact that he's gracious and giving to his name being changed to do something with a false god and false worship. Mishael, meaning, who is what God is? Who's like God? Who is what God is? Just the end of his name is changed. Instead of Mishael, with El being a reference to God, the end is changed to Ak, Meshach. Shak, a reference to the Babylonian goddess Shishak, the goddess of love and mirth. So again, this change in names to something to do with false worship and Babylonian gods. And finally, Azariah. Jehovah has helped, or the Lord has helped, his name changed to Abednego. Servant of Nego, or Nebo. Nebo being a reference to one of their divinities, possibly one of the planets or their worship of it. So again, the names of these young men are changed from something relating to praising, honoring the true God to meanings connected with the false gods and idols of the Babylonians. Why give them these new names? Well, these new names were an attempt to further remove these young men from their heritage, from their religion, from their beliefs, their background. Try to just get them to forget who they are. They're going to be learning for 3 years all about the customs, the language, the culture of the Chaldeans, so we might as well give them some names that focus on these things as well. Really, they were trying to assimilate these young men into the culture of false worship around them in Babylon. How did they respond? Did they just give in and assimilate to that culture? Or did they stand for their convictions? Well, notice verse 8. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine with which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Purposed in his heart, he made this determination in his own heart, his own mind, that he would not act against his conscience in this matter and eat these provisions. They likely included not only unclean meats, but meat and drink that had been offered to the pagan gods of Babylon. It's interesting, though, that Daniel didn't fight the things that he couldn't really change, like the name that he would be called by the Babylonian leaders ruling over him. But in matters of conscience, where he would not let the circumstances govern his behavior and cause him to go against what he believed was right, he calmly and wisely found an alternative, found a way to deal with this. Verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and the goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs, and the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who has appointed your food and drink, for why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Now notice what it didn't say here. When he gets a little bit of pushback from the chief of the eunuchs here, Daniel didn't respond and say, you know, verse 11 doesn't say, and Daniel said, no one's going to tell me what I'm supposed to eat. I won't do it. You can't make me. Give me celery or give me death. No, he calmly, wisely presented an alternative to this authority he was subject to, expecting God's blessing to provide a way for him to act in faith, to live in good conscience, and continue in a pattern of obedience. He didn't allow the circumstances he was living in to get him to give up his convictions. He exercised this calm wisdom, which has a much more positive effect than an emotional reaction or demands or accusations against others. I know what you're trying to do to me here. You're trying to get me to do something that's wrong. You're trying to get me to worship your false gods. But he simply said, how about this? Let us try out just the vegetables and water, and if it doesn't cause a problem, can we work this out together? Now, circumstances are sometimes outside of our control, but our response to them is not. Daniel had the wisdom to know when to take a stance on something and how to approach it, and when to recognize something wasn't worth the battle. Okay, these other people are going to call me by this name. I know that's not my name. I'm not worshiping those false gods. But when it comes to something I have some control over, you know what? I'm not going to act against my convictions here. These circumstances are not going to change my conduct. Our response to the circumstances we find ourselves in can truly be an indicator of the king we serve. Do we give in and just serve the kings of men? Or is our service to the true king? We see that Daniel was blessed in this matter. He said, let our appearance be examined before you after this period of 10 days, verse 13, and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. Just let us give it a try. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them after 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of the delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. And as for these four young men, God gave them more knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all manners of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm, even more so than these men who had experience. See, God blessed the efforts of Daniel and his friends for standing up for their convictions, not just allowing the circumstances to change them. He could have even easily given in to the circumstances around him and just eaten the food. Apparently, that's what the rest of these young captives did. It's only these four that are mentioned requesting to be vegetarians for a time. He could have likewise responded with an aggressive, accusatory stance on those who were trying to feed him these things. He could have stood in judgment, condemning everybody else who was eating these things instead of standing up against it. Instead, he just wisely, calmly, level-headedly offered a solution that would allow him to live in good conscience, and God blessed his efforts. Regardless of who sits on an earthly throne, the circumstances it might create for the people of God, are we going to be willing to just calmly, wisely stand for our convictions, do what we're supposed to do, and not allow the circumstances around us to change what we stand for, to change who we are? I mean, back to the names. They were trying to get them to forget who they were and where they had come from, who they really served. But Daniel wouldn't let that happen. God can bless our efforts when we determine to live righteously, regardless of the circumstances we find ourselves in. He can grant us favor in the eyes of the physical leaders that we're subject to when our hearts are set on serving the true King. Circumstances don't always change, but perhaps our ability to thrive under those circumstances can. So what's our response to change in leadership? When you think about it, what's the big fear surrounding a change in leadership in a nation? Is it not a fear that things will change? Circumstances will be different. The good things that we appreciate will be gone. The bad things will get worse. Well, some circumstances are outside of our control, and they may change. Maybe not in the next 4 years, but inevitably and eventually they will change. The economy might tank. Government regulations might increase. Freedoms we once enjoyed might be missed. But all of these things are true regardless of who's elected, by the way. What will we purpose in our hearts regardless of the circumstances we find ourselves in? What will our response be to changing circumstances as prophecy marches on? And we might find ourselves in some unpleasant circumstances. Like Daniel and his friends, we should respond with conviction to remember who we are, a conviction to remember where we came from and where we're going. When life changes, we can be like Daniel and purpose in our hearts to remain loyal to our God and King, regardless of changes implemented under a physical king. So at the end of chapter 1, verse 21, it says, thus Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus. This gives us a scope of the life of Daniel. So he and his friends, you know, were recognized as standing out above all the others who experienced this training. And it says, Daniel continued in this type of service until the first year of King Cyrus. That means he experienced the reign and rule, the passing of the baton with Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Darius, Cyrus. four different leaders, four different unique personalities, four different approaches and perspectives, but consistency in Daniel because he knew who the king was that he really served. I wonder what he might have witnessed being so close to the action, serving in the king's palace. And my guess is probably a mixture of good and evil, just like we see today. But being a sojourner and a pilgrim, not a citizen of the nation he lived in, Daniel likely saw a lot that he could easily identify as in opposition to God's truth, things like idolatry, brutality, revelry, anger, pride. What impact did that have on Daniel personally? On his own character? Point number three, darkness did not diminish his example of light. Darkness did not diminish his example of light. Not only did he not allow the circumstances to change his convictions, he didn't allow the darkness of the lifestyle of those around him, of the leaders serving above him, to change his own example of light. Let's go to Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. In verse 1, we read, Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and the silver vessels which his father, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, just like we read in Daniel chapter 1. He took things from the city along with him. So they call for these things, for these gold and silver vessels from the temple of God, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. They're having a big drinking party, and they say, let's bring out the nice dishes, the ones from the temple of that god. So they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. In verse 5, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. And the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened, and his knees knocked against each other. I imagine so. Can you imagine a hand just appearing out of nowhere and writing a message on the wall? I mean, this is before the days of projectors, right? And right now, we'd all be looking at Scott. What'd you do? The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, many commentators say the reason why he was offering this position of the third ruler of the kingdom is perhaps Belshazzar was part of a co-regency at this time, meaning his father Nebuchadnezzar was still alive and still in that number one spot. Yet Belshazzar is referred to as the king, but in this co-regency where perhaps his father's not physically able to fill the role in the same way, and Belshazzar's filling the practical role, but still second in line. So he's offering the highest position he possibly could, the third position in the kingdom. Verse 8, now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. But notice what happens next. Something comes to mind. The queen, likely the queen mother here, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There's a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, Now let Daniel be called, and he'll give the interpretation. Verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I've heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. We're not going to read the rest of this passage about the writing on the wall here, because what I want to highlight here is that three times it's pointed out this reputation that Daniel had that preceded him, this example of light. His example was not diminished over the years by the evil leadership around him. He didn't give in to the culture around him that he lived in. He continued to be a positive example of light. And the reason why, the source of that light and wisdom and positive example are pointed out. It's the Spirit of the Holy God. Even these Gentile leaders recognized something different is at work here. The example of this man stands out like a bright, shining light. And that example transcended the reign of multiple kings. Even the unrighteous leaders themselves knew the source of this light wasn't really Daniel himself. It was the Spirit of God shining in him. And again, that's an example for us, especially in this time of darkness, in this time of the politics of this world where people are just at each other's throats. We have the opportunity to shine as a light in that darkness. Not to participate in it and jump in and be part of it, but to shine through that darkness. If we go back to chapter 4 in verse 18, it wasn't just, you know, in this account here, it wasn't just the queen who recognized this spirit at work in Daniel. Back in chapter 4, verse 18, it says, Daniel speaking here, Nebuchadnezzar speaking, this dream I, Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, aka Daniel, declare its interpretation, since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. Nebuchadnezzar recognized it. His wife, the queen, recognized it. His son, Belshazzar, mentions it. And in chapter 6, another king Daniel served under, Darius. Not sure which is the proper pronunciation. Take your pick. Mr. D. Chapter 6, verse 1, says, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. So he's, you know, beginning to rule, take this position of power after conquering Belshazzar and the Babylonian kingdom. And Darius puts Daniel in a position of power. And verse 3 says, then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. I think the fact that three separate kings experienced and mentioned the excellent spirit in Daniel, plus the queen, the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, this is evidence of the consistency of Daniel's positive example. And time did not change that example. Circumstances did not change that example. Worldly behavior of darkness around him, even the darkness of the behaviors and the perspectives of the leaders above him, did not change that example he was setting. The righteousness of the physical ruler of the day, or lack thereof, didn't dictate what Daniel's example would be. His example had a very different source, the Spirit of God. The same source that should be at work in us to shine as an example in this dark world. 2 Corinthians 4, let's notice verses 6 and 7. We know Christ told his disciples, including us, that we're to be the light of the world, a city set on a hill, a lamp to provide light in the house. But where does that light come from? What is its source? It's not just our own efforts. That light has a source at work in us. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 6 says, "It is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." The same God that commanded light to just appear out of nowhere in the creation account. He's the one that gives us the ability to shine as a light today. Verse 7, "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us." We're these earthen vessels, these clay pots. But there's this incredible treasure that we've been given to dwell in us, God's Spirit. And it shines as a light so that there can be no doubt that the power is of God and not of us. We can shine that light of a positive example and not be overtaken by the darkness around us, including the political environment we live in, when we recognize the treasure that's at work in us. When we don't give in to the darkness around us, but strive instead to shine as a light. Does your example, does my example show the work of an excellent Spirit in us? Does that example change depending on something as simple as who sits in a temporary position of authority? Or who sits as in the highest office of a nation that we're just sojourning in anyways? Or is our character consistent and our example consistent like that of Daniel, regardless of who the physical king is? Again, back to Daniel chapter 2, back to this image, this great image with made of these various materials. Again, Daniel was able to consistently be this positive example of light because of what he knew about the future as well. He knew the temporary kingdoms of man were going to come to an end. Daniel 2 and verse 35. "Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold..." All of these materials that made up this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in this dream were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. In verse 44 and 45, we learn that stone that becomes a great mountain and fills the earth represents the kingdom of God. Verse 44, "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this." The stone that became a great mountain breaks in pieces and consumes all these other kingdoms and stands forever. Our example of character is not contingent on the right leader sitting on a temporary throne that's going to become dust one day. If we allow the world around us, which is darkness, to dictate our attitudes and our actions, we're simply serving the wrong king. But like Daniel, we can set a consistent example of an excellent Spirit in us when we focus on reflecting the light of our eternal King, regardless of who sits on a temporary throne. And really, this season that we're in, between now and Election Day in November, is prime time for the light to stand out. Because there's so much darkness in the very approach to the politics of this world. Let's move on. Point number 4, persecution did not shake his devotion. Now, isn't that something that people fear about a change in leadership? What if our freedoms are removed? What if we begin to be persecuted as the people of God? Well, Daniel was persecuted, and it did not shake his devotion to his true king. Another transition of power happened after the writing on the wall incident. Daniel told Belshazzar that very night that he was going to be overthrown, and it came to pass. That very night is when the city was invaded and Darius took over, and the Medo-Persian Empire began to reign instead of the Babylonian Empire. Back to Daniel 6, we read verses 1 through 3 when Darius is setting up his leadership, and these three governors, And in verse 4, we read and learn that these other leaders and governors were jealous of Daniel. Verse 4, the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." They knew they weren't going to be able to get this guy out of the way who was keeping them from being recognized and having the positions of authority they wanted. We weren't going to be able to get him out of the way unless they could find a way to turn his faith and obedience to the law of God against him. Daniel was being persecuted. But in verse 10, I mean, we're skipping over the details here. This is the lion's den passage. They convince the king, they butter him up and convince him to make this decree that if anybody, you know, calls upon, prays to, etc., any other leader besides you, they'll be cast into a den of lions. Verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he knew it. And yet, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. He simply continued to do the things that he knew were right, the things that he knew he needed to do to maintain his relationship with God. He understood the proper balance between submitting to the governing authorities whom God had allowed to be placed over him, while also knowing where he needed to draw a line in the sand and say, I need to obey God rather than men. I need to do what God expects me to do, regardless of the persecution of others. In the future, brethren, there may be consequences of us taking a similar stance when we're being persecuted for obedience to God. But we can't allow that persecution to shake us. Note Darius' comments about Daniel after this whole lion's den scenario plays out. Was there any doubt in the mind of this king, Darius, whom Daniel was really devoted to and who he was really serving? Down in verse 20, well, verse 19 says, the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And verse 20, when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. You know, he knew who Daniel ultimately served. He even refers to him as Daniel, not Daniel's servant to the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, not Daniel's servant to me. He says, Daniel's servant to the living God. And even in his decree that he writes and sends out here, he speaks highly of God as the living God and steadfast forever in verse 26. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. This Gentile king saying that, acknowledging that the living God is the one whose kingdom shall endure forever. And that was in part because of the incredible example of faith, steadfastness, devotion to God, even in the face of persecution, this incredible example that Daniel set. Does our conduct and faithfulness likewise convince others that our God rules? Regardless of which physical human being is in power, even when persecution comes, I guess that depends on whether or not it's clear to others which king we really serve. Do we serve the king, the leader of a political party? Or do we serve the everlasting God who will rule over the kingdoms of men, whose kingdom will be established and will endure forever? I'm going to move on. Final point, number 5. Daniel's true allegiance did not limit his compassion. I think this is an important point for us to consider, especially over the next few months in this time leading up to the election in this country. His true allegiance did not limit his compassion. We've seen clearly that Daniel was a servant to the coming king, regardless of who the physical king was. But that focus on the future did not cause him to be cold and uncaring toward those that he was subjected to in his present. back in Daniel chapter 4. Let's read verse 19. Daniel 4 and verse 19. He's interpreting this dream for Nebuchadnezzar, and he understands the meaning of it, and notice what he says here. Daniel 4, verse 19. He understood that this dream was not good for Nebuchadnezzar. It was a prophecy of the fact that God was going to cut Nebuchadnezzar down and allow him to live like an animal for a period of time because of his pride. Verse 19, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time and his thoughts troubled him. You know, after comprehending the meaning of this dream. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. And Belteshazzar, Daniel, answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. Now there's this terrible dream about what was going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, the king that destroyed Daniel's homeland, that caused death and destruction and hunger and famine, that brought Daniel into captivity in a foreign land, that took Daniel's freedoms and set him in a position of service for the rest of his life. And his response to this king is, let this be about someone else and not you. He still had compassion and care for this human leader, even though they didn't agree on everything. Many things, I would say. Down in verse 27, after explaining the interpretation of the dream, it says, therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. See, he still had the good in mind for Nebuchadnezzar, even after all he had experienced under his hand. He was the king that had been in charge, who was directly responsible for the many life changes that Daniel had endured, and yet he still had compassion for him. We see something similar, in a sense, in that interaction with Darius. The morning after this night of sleeping with the lions, remember, Darius checked on him. Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions? And how did Daniel reply? Leave me alone. You're the one that threw me in here. Or why don't you come in here and find out? Now, his reply to the king was, O king, live forever. In our day and age, we can easily confuse compassion with consensus. As if we show care or compassion from other people, that means we agree with them. That if we respect someone in a position of leadership because of the office they fulfill, that somehow we're agreeing with their choices and perspectives. Compassion is not contingent on agreement. In fact, our expressions of compassion and honor for others are fueled by our allegiance to the coming king. We can and should have compassion and respect for the leaders set above us. You know, Colossians 3, verses 22 through 24, you can jot that down. We're going to not turn there right now because it's getting lengthy. But it tells us, whatever we do, do it heartily to the Lord, because regardless of who we serve physically, our perspective should be that we're serving our Lord Christ. We're serving God. When we have respect and honor for the physical leaders above us, it's because of our honor, our service to our true King. Let's look at 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4. We will turn here. 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4. Honoring, respecting, having compassion on, and even praying for the physical leaders of our country, regardless of who they are, regardless of whether or not we agree with their policies and perspectives, is consistent with showing allegiance to our true King, Jesus Christ and God our Father. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, I exhort first of all that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men that we like. No, not quite. It's not what it says. Supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men Verse 2, for kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceful life in all godliness and reverence. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of our God, of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. So we're instructed to pray for those in authority over us, so that we can reap the benefits of peace now, but also that's placed here in the context of God's ultimate perspective on mankind. That his plan and this kingdom that he's going to set up, which will never be destroyed, is for their benefit too. How should we respond to the fractured political climate that we're living in today? I think this last passage we'll read here sums it up pretty well in Titus chapter 3. Titus 3, verses 1 and 2. Paul writing to Titus, reminding him of his role as a young pastor, and he says, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. That's what's expected of us, brethren. That's the kind of example that we consistently see in this man of God who lived through hardship and changing circumstances and darkness and persecution, yet who'd never lost sight of his true allegiance. Daniel served under many kings in less than ideal conditions, yet his compassion and character remained intact because he remembered whom he really served. Let's not get caught up in the politics of this world, in its methods and its rhetoric. Let's follow Daniel's example, especially in this season of the year that we're heading into, this election season. And regardless of who sits on a temporary earthly throne as president or king, let's remember we are servants of the King.